We have with us two groups, one from Beaver Dam High School. Would you please stand so we can greet you, the students from Beaver Dam? Welcome. Thank you for coming. Please be seated. And one from Shoring High School. Would you please stand? We're delighted to see you. Thank you. You may be seated. These high schools are here today with the Court with Class program. This is a national award-winning program replicated in other states. It is a joint effort of the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. These students have received materials on the case they're about to hear. And then they will have an opportunity at lunchtime at noon to meet with Justice Bradley and discuss the procedures of the court. They will be joined by the Walworth County High School, that high school will be in for the 1045 case. So we're delighted to welcome you here with this program, even on this nasty, dull, dreary day. That's to be contrasted to the case we're about to hear. Let me introduce the bench to you. On the far left is an empty chair that is ordinarily occupied by Justice David Prosser, but he will not be participating in this first case. So the first person you see on the left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right, Justice John Wilcox. And to the far right, Justice Patrick Crooks. With the introductions made, I'm going to now call the first case, which is 97-3524, State v. Larry J. Sprosty. Representing the state of Wisconsin is Warren D. Weinstein, who's Assistant Attorney General.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I am Warren Weinstein, an Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin in this case. This case presents not a question of whether there's a statutory or a constitutional violation if the state fails to provide a supervised release option to a particular individual who's been committed under our sex predator Chapter 980 statute. Rather, in my view, what it presents is whether or not the existence and availability of facilities is an appropriate factor for the circuit court to consider in arriving at the initial decision of whether or not a person is appropriate for supervised release. And as I see it, that presents two distinct questions to the circuit court, or to this court, for the circuit court, which is, first, is it appropriate for the circuit court to consider whether or not, either in the state as a whole or locally, there is a facility that has sufficient security to adequately protect the public if this person were to be placed in a community setting? And secondly, and much more difficult question, and the question that ultimately caused the big problem in this case, is what does the circuit court do if there either are no facilities at all, or there are some facilities, but for whatever reason, those facilities will not accept this particular individual? The first question, I think, requires statutory construction of 980.06.
I wonder if you could just step back and just remind us of the statutory procedures. person has reached a mandatory release date and the department has filed a petition that they be restrained and retained, right, in an institution?
Yes.
And I assume that Mr. Sprosty was so retained in an institution, right?
Yes, he had actually been adjudicated as a sexually violent person, and the circuit court had committed him to a secure mental health facility. And that, while that was on appeal...
Is that a jury or a judge?
I'm sorry?
Is that a jury determination or a judge?
I believe it was, but I'm not... the determination of his commitment was to the
judge.
Court, but I believe his determination that he was a sex predator was a jury determination.
Okay. So he was then committed.
Right.
And?
He appealed the determination that he was sexually violent. While that appeal was pending, he filed... Of course, this was during the period where the constitutionality of the statute was in question, and a lot of the things in the Court of Appeals were kind of placed on hold while that
right.
was eventually decided. And so that as the time ran, he became able to, under the statute, to file a petition for supervised release, which
right.
he did prior to his the appeal on his initial determination being decided. And so this all is going on in the circuit court at the same time the Court of Appeals is considering whether or not there was error in the initial commitment.
All right, but we're here on his supervisory release petition.
Yes, that's what we're here on, the supervised release petition. The Court of Appeals affirmed the commitment, and I don't remember now whether there was a petition for review or not.
And what's the burden of proof, and who has it?
The state has it by clear and convincing evidence.
To prove what?
Well, what the statute says is to prove that this person remains to be dangerous, as that term is defined, meaning the substantial probability, and that he continues to be dangerous unless he is retained in a secure mental health facility. Part of the problem in this case, I think, because of the fact that it was one of the earlier cases after, this is only 8 or 9 months, this aspect of it was tried after this court found the statute constitutional, and the trial court interpreted that language to focus on a second look at the recidivism probability kind of analysis that it is normally done in the first hearing. And as a result, there was very little evidence about placement and what requirements treatment or security were necessary if this person... If Mr. Sprosky could be placed into the community. There was one or two sentences in the expert testimony and the expert report from the Mr. Sprosky's expert, where that expert opined that he could be treated in the community under, quote, close supervision.
Give me the statute that says the state has the burden of proof to prove the person dangerous with a substantial probability and continues to be dangerous unless secured.
I'm sorry?
What's the statute?
That statute is 980.08.
980.08.
Sub
5? Or 4?
Okay. 980.08 sub 3, I believe, because 04 is the section that, well, it's probably the same section.
Shall grant the petition unless the state proves by the clear and convincing evidence. I think that's what the chief is
right, saying. That's right. And then the next sentence is the factors in which the circuit court may consider in arriving at a decision of whether or not to place the person on supervised release.
Now, I've had problems with 04, I mean subsection 4 in this case, Mr. Weinstein, because that sentence says, without equivocation, the court shall grant the petition unless the state meets its burden. Period.
Right.
But then the next sentence says, in making a decision, the court may consider the appropriate facilities.
Which implies a discretionary decision.
Right. I don't know. How do you what do you say? Balance those two sentences within the same subsection.
I think it's difficult, and I think that presents one of the problems. The initial. And the other thing is, if you really think about that, 980.08 really doesn't call into question the person's dangerousness at all. If the person is no longer dangerous, you really ought to be released under 980.09. What really is at issue in a 980.08 petition is this person's dangerousness of a sufficiently high level to require that he be continued in a secure mental health facility?
Well, that's what it says. It says that it is substantially probable that the person will engage in acts of sexual violence if the person is not continued in institutional care.
Right.
Institutional care.
That's right.
So if you say that it's probable, it won't be that you don't need institutional care, but you need some kind of other care, then
right.
Under that statute, the court should order a release under the other care. And then it says, making a decision, the court may consider how the person will support themselves and what arrangements are available to ensure that the person has access to and will participate in necessary treatment.
And where the person will live is also one of the factors.
Right.
Now, you seem to be reading that statute. Correct me if I'm wrong, but your position is, I think, that if there are no facilities available, no appropriate facilities for supervisory release, notwithstanding the language that says the court shall release if the state doesn't carry the burden, notwithstanding that language, the court still has it within its authority, the circuit court has it within its authority to keep the person confined.
Well, I view that as a discretionary decision of the circuit court. And it should focus on whether or not the reasons that there are no facilities are reasonable reasons. I mean, I don't think, and I'm not trying to argue to the court, that the state can merely say, gee, we don't have any facilities, and that's the end of it.
Well, why not? I thought that was your argument, as a matter of fact. Why does the state have to provide any facilities outside of the institution? Seems to me that the state can say, we're not providing it. It's too expensive. There are less than 200 people involved here that are now in institutional care, I assume. So why do we have to provide for 200 people? You have to provide a facility. I guess the words, $1 million was thrown out here. And why do that? For one person or for 200 people. So why can't the state just say, we're not providing these facilities, and then under the statute, the person can stay forever in an institution. And maybe that's permitted under the Kansas U.S. Supreme Court decision.
It is permitted under Kansas's statute, but Kansas did not provide for any supervised release at all. And our statute does, setting aside any constitutional problems. I think at a minimum, that establishes some burden on the state statutorily to provide supervised release in appropriate cases.
How do you force the state to do that?
I'm sorry?
How do you force the state to do that? Is the state building any such facilities now?
My understanding, very much of this is not in the record, and because of the way these cases come up, it rarely makes it into the record. My understanding is that the state does not operate any kind of halfway houses of any kind, either 980 or probation and parole. All of those are operated by private entities who contract with either DOC, and in this case, all of them are contracted with DOC. DHFS contracts with DOC to provide placement for 980 persons at this point.
And I understand that, as in this case, that they have the complete discretion to deny the application, as Crawford County here tried to get the individual into one of these institutions. There are four of them, and they said, no, you don't qualify. So that there is, in other words, so literally, other than having the state build something, that they have the ultimate say, the individual institutions.
I would imagine that depends on the contract that DOC has with the entity. And the contracts weren't in the record, and I really don't know the specifics of these particular contracts. I understand that they vary quite a bit from one institution to another. So I'm assuming at least some of them have provisions that allow the entity to say unconditionally, this is not someone we will take.
Counsel, why shouldn't I be sitting here saying, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. Why shouldn't I be saying that when the guts of the Carpenter decision and of the Post decision was based on a presumption? The Post decision states at page 279 of 197 was second. We presume the legislature will proceed in good faith and fund the treatment programs necessary for those committed under Chapter 980. As the author of Carpenter, the basic premise, citing these statutes that are right before us, as to the double jeopardy constitutionality, relied on the state's argument that this was not merely a pretense, and that treatment is not secondary in punishment, to punishment. That treatment was the gravamen, the treatment was the essence of this statute. And so I dealt with several paragraphs in Carpenter saying, boy, I believe the state. I believe that this is for treatment. I believe that this is to be the least restrictive environment. I believe that if the court finds supervised release to be appropriate, that the law requires the county where the person resides to prepare a plan that identifies the treatment that the person will then receive in the community, and the person must be released. I believe that. And now we're faced with a case where a court made a finding under sub 4 that it is not substantially probable that the person will engage in acts of sexual violence any longer, you know, if not confined to a secure institution. That a court made a finding that the state has failed to meet its burden by evidence that is clear and convincing, that the person shall be released. And now you stand here, I know it's more to be an assistant attorney general before me when I wrote this opinion, but now you stand here and say, but no treatment, surprise, surprise, surprise.
Well, I have several responses to that.
Sure.
First is, treatment's not the issue here. I mean, there is treatment available both in the institution and outside of it. The treatment, the issue here is the sufficient security to protect the public, which was also one of the purposes of adopting the statute. But more importantly, the record in this case, I don't think, indicates, well, it's too sketchy at this time, in my view, to draw the conclusion that the state either cannot or will not provide a supervised release position for Mr. Sprosty. I really think that this I don't want to fault the circuit court here, because this was pretty early on and it was rather sketchy, and I think the court tried to do the best it could under the circumstances, and may have, given where we were at that point. But I think the record really ought to show exactly why these halfway houses wouldn't take this person. It could well be that some of those reasons have since been rejected by the Court of Appeals. I note, for instance, that one of them said, well, he's out of our area. We've got a Court of Appeals decision now that says that's you can't do that. You have to look at through the whole state. And if that were the case, I think the circuit court would be justified in saying to that halfway house, no, I'm not going to buy that.
Well, the trial court here did say that it doesn't have to be in Crawford County. Any place in the whole state.
Right, that's right. And yet, one of the halfway houses apparently did do that. But I would like, if in the ideal world at least, I would like the record to show that these halfway houses and the state isn't just ducking, but there are reasons which both the circuit court and this court can consider to determine whether or not those reasons for not accepting this person are reasonable. Second thing is, I'm sorry.
What would we do about it if we did? These are private organizations, aren't they?
Yes, they are, but I think, well, it would depend on the contract. I think it may be that certainly the agencies of the state are subject to the order of the court.
You concede that the state has the financial responsibility to pay for appropriate treatment facilities,
well,
don't you?
I'm assuming that, although I think the Court of Appeals raises some question about that.
But you concede that.
Yes, we concede that. And
that
so
the state has the financial responsibility to fund the treatment facilities, to provide halfway houses if appropriate, if that's part of the treatment. You concede that.
Right. Right. The other thing is, I think there has been, the opinion in Carpenter and Post, I can't remember which one has dealt with which issue, but one of them I know relies on Halpern, United States.
Carpenter does.
And the Supreme Court has retreated substantially from Halpern since that point. And this particular case has not been briefed by the parties in terms of a constitutional issue.
The constitutionality of the statute is not before us. Is that right?
That's my view, yes.
Okay. And so you don't want to revisit that. You want to just do a statutory interpretation?
I think that's what the court is presented with.
Where is Mr. Sprosty right now?
He's at WRC right now.
Has he filed another petition?
Not that I'm aware of.
Has the time passed so he can file another petition?
It's fast approaching if it hasn't already passed. And we may be seeing it again.
Mr. Weinstein, in light of Carpenter and Post, in which we said that, we emphasized that the constitutionality hinged on remedial treatment and on least restrictive, if we were to go with your route and say you don't have to release Sprosty under supervised release if there aren't any facilities available, because that's how I read the bottom line.
If there truly aren't.
If there truly aren't. And as a practical matter, I think that will be the case, because I don't see these four private institutions voluntarily take, an institution in Portage County taking 10 people from La Crosse County and four from Vilas County. They'll just close up shop. As a practical matter, I see this case as whether or not the state has to provide some kind of treatment, but that's neither here nor there at this point. To my question, how do we reconcile your position with the constitutional basis upon which Carpenter and Post depended? And don't we raise constitutional problems or at least aren't constitutional problems presented if we go the route that you are suggesting?
I think they clearly are presented, but in my view,
how are they resolved?
I hesitate to do this because it's not fully briefed, and it really is a complex argument on both sides. But I think in terms of ex post facto and double jeopardy, that cannot be an attack as applied. That must be a facial analysis of the statutory scheme. Now, that does not mean that there may not be a substantive due process problem, but I think, as the Chief Justice noted, Kansas didn't have supervised release at all, and the Supreme Court adopt or passed that statute under a substantial due process.
So you're suggesting that possibly we can ignore 980, the supervisory release problem, say this is discretionary with the state. If the state doesn't want to provide these facilities, okay, because Kansas says that just a petition to get released is sufficient to pass constitutional muster.
Well, I don't, that is what Kansas said,
right. But
or the Supreme Court said in Kansas versus Hendricks, but I'm not suggesting that the supervised release option can be ignored in view of our statute. What I am suggesting is that one of the factors in arriving at whether or not supervised release is appropriate in this particular case is whether or not it's reasonably feasible that there are facilities with both treatment, which is rarely the problem, and adequate security to protect the community. If there are, and for some reason there's some roadblock, I think the circuit court ought to have the authority to say, you've got to take this guy. You've got to put this guy in the facility to the DHFS or DOC or whoever.
In a community in which a facility is located.
Under Keating, that's the requirement, yes.
Because this is supervised release, not supervised confinement.
That's right.
What, but does the state have any facility in this state?
Not directly, either probation on parole or DHFS.
They only have the private facilities with which they contract. But if no private facilities are willing to take these individuals, then the state has no provision at this time for having any housing for any of these individuals, absent private. And if we can't order private, then what does the court do?
Well, I'm not sure that you can't, that the circuit court can't, under the appropriate circumstances, order.
Well, that might be a stop.
If you can't directly order the private facility to take it, but by ordering the agency with the contract, they would be able to do that.
So the circuit court can order the state to provide out-of-institution treatment and security. That's your position? Circuit court can say state provide.
If the circuit court's satisfied that the security and the treatment are reasonably feasible, yes.
Well, what did the trial court think that here? But then just couldn't find a place to put him?
Yes, he did, but the problem was that when he made that decision, he really didn't have any evidence about facilities or security.
Yeah, but this is circular.
If the trial court believes, on the basis of the evidence, that this person can be released in a safe manner for the public, but of course a restricted release, that is with conditions, etc., the trial court believes that, but there is no such existing facility. Can the trial court say to the state, get one?
If, and this is the problem, because of the way this is set up, and this is kind of the way the initial petition statute is structured, the first phase of the hearing focuses not on any kind of placement or security problems, but on what is the diagnosis and how dangerous is this guy. And if the court has to make a placement decision at that point, it rarely knows exactly. And
right. But you have the burden of proof. That's why I started you several steps back. You have the burden of proof at this initial phase to prove that the person is still dangerous, and that there's a substantial probability that the person will continue to be dangerous unless secured in an institution. Is that the first step that you have to prove?
Okay. On the petition for release, yes.
Right. So if you've
got higher burden on the initial.
Right. And you didn't prove it here, apparently, because the trial court found...
Well, yeah, from the trial court's ruling, that's right.
Yeah. The trial court found that you did not carry your burden of proof. Now, the trial court could have released this person into the community without conditions, but that's not what the trial court believed on the basis of the evidence.
I'm not sure that that's true,
okay.
but that I don't think is a major point.
That's not an issue, right. So then the trial court has to decide, when you didn't carry your burden of proof of keeping him in an institution, what to do with this person, right?
That's right.
And the trial court said they wanted a facility that maintained public safety, and yet was not an institution that the person was in, right?
Ultimately, that's what he concluded, yes.
Right. And then the trial court couldn't find a place for this person, right?
Couldn't find a place that it believed had adequate security. That's right.
That's right. So then the trial court was stuck. On one hand, it found the person didn't have to be institutionalized because you didn't carry the burden of proof. On the other hand, it didn't have a place to put him for public safety, right?
Right.
So then what the trial court did was send him back to the institution, even though you didn't carry your burden. I say you, I mean the state.
Yes, that and that's a fair way, I think, to look at this. But the problem is that the statute doesn't clearly tell the circuit court, and hopefully this case will, that to make that determination.
So you don't carry your burden of proof, but then you don't provide a facility. Therefore, the trial court can go back and say, okay, you got to stay in the institution. I mean, that's what you're saying the statute provides.
That's what happened in this case. In my view, the statute, the trial court really ought to not focus on the evidence that it focused on in this. This, in my view, this petition should be the second part of the bifurcated hearing in the initial petition. And it should focus solely on what are the facilities out there and what is the level of dangerousness of this person.
But it is a bifurcated procedure.
Well, there's no, and that's my point. In this kind of a petition, the first question's really not at issue, because if the first question was at issue, we ought to be under 09 talking about discharge. But that's not the way the circuit court proceeded in this case. See, my time has expired.
And it's because the statutes seem to have conflict in them.
That's right. It does seem to have conflict.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. You have a few moments for rebuttal. Mr. Kelly, representing the defendant, Larry J. Sprotsky.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Chris Kelly, and I do represent Mr. Sprotsky in this appeal. I think the only issue that the court needs to address in this appeal is whether a trial court, after finding that Chapter 980 patient is appropriate for supervised release, must require that a plan be prepared which actually accomplishes that release. We contend that's what the statute requires. That's what Judge Kirchman should have done, but ultimately failed to do. That's what the Court of Appeals told him to do, because that's what the statute requires. We think the Court of Appeals' decision should be affirmed on that basis. And that's really all the Supreme Court needs to decide in this case. What I want to touch upon during the course of this argument are, first of all, whether Judge Kirchman reconsidered his decision under subsection 4 of the statute that Mr. Sprotsky was appropriate for release, which is an issue that the state raised in its brief. Secondly, whether Judge Kirchman erred by not requiring a county to prepare a release plan, in other words, a plan that actually accomplished Mr. Sprotsky's release. And thirdly, and briefly, if I have an opportunity to get to it, suggest why this court shouldn't consider the issue of who should pay for that plan if a plan is ultimately implemented. To touch briefly on the issue of whether this was a reconsideration, I think as the court's questioning and as the state's responses indicate, the issue under subsection 4 of 980.08 is really whether the state has proved by clear and convincing evidence that a Chapter 980 patient is still sexually violent, and if so, whether he is still substantially likely to engage in acts of sexual violence if he doesn't continue to be institutionalized. Judge Kirchman held an evidentiary hearing on that issue. There were witnesses for both the state and for Mr. Sprotsky who testified. They were mental health experts. They testified under oath. They were subject to cross-examination. Judge Kirchman listened to their testimony. He made a factual determination that the state failed to carry its burden of proof. I don't think that was a discretionary determination. I think he found, as a matter of fact, that the state did not carry its burden of proof. From that point, the case moves on to subsection 5, which deals with how do we accomplish Mr. Skwasty's release once the judge decides that he's appropriate for release.
I wish it were that easy, counsel, but obviously it's not, because we don't move on to section 5 until we go through the rest of section 4. And, okay, maybe here we had a reconsideration, but I don't think this court accepted this case to determine whether or not you could have a reconsideration, because there's other cases in the pipeline where there's no reconsideration necessary, I would assume. And the question is going to be squarely presented at some point whether or not the availability of facilities plays a role in that initial determination under 04. That's where I see the real nut in this case. It seems to me this court can go two ways. One, we can say that we can go your way and say that there is no discretion once the court finds that he's a proper subject for release. The other is to interpret 980.04 and 05 as purely discretionary statutes. That, in fact, although that 980.04 says, yeah, the state has the burden of proving this, but in making the final decision as to whether or not to release this person into the community, the court may take into account the availability or lack of availability of facilities. And therefore, the legislature intended this statute, this entire scheme under 980.04, detention and supervised release, to be dependent upon the availability of facilities, and if not, you don't have to do it, state. And that would be consistent, as I read Kansas, that would be consistent with the Constitution. So I don't think you can blithely skip to sub 5 without going through goal, which is in 980.04. And that section that says the court may consider the availability of facilities.
Well, let me say initially that if subsection 4 does require a trial court to consider specific placement options that actually exist or don't exist in the community, it was the state's burden to present that evidence during the hearing on subsection 4. And if the state failed to present that evidence and Judge Kirchman made the ruling that he did, that's tough luck for the state. Moving beyond that and getting to the more theoretical question that the court asks, I don't think the structure of the statute supports a reading that it is incumbent upon the court at the hearing under subsection 4 to consider actual placement alternatives that are available or unavailable at that time. I think if that were what the court were to do, subsection 4 and subsection 5 would be collapsed into a single section, and there wouldn't be any need to prepare a release plan that identifies treatment and services that the person will receive in the community, because that would have already been done.
But the very first words of sub 5 say, if the court finds that the person is appropriate for supervised release, which moves us immediately back to sub 4. And the court there, the third sentence says, in making the decision, the court can take into account the availability of facilities.
And I think what subsection 4 is saying to the court is that it should consider whether something like a halfway house would be sufficient to protect the community. Does this person have to continue in institutionalized care? Or can the court think of alternatives, or does the evidence support the fact that alternatives that are less restrictive would be sufficient to protect society? So, for instance, when Dr. Armentrout testifies, or his report says, that close supervision in the community would be appropriate, and if there is testimony that that means something like a halfway house or it means electronic monitoring, The court can consider those factors, but the court doesn't say, well, is there a specific halfway house that is available today that will accept Mr. Sprosky today? Because that requires actually referring Mr. Sprosky to the halfway house, finding out if the halfway house will indeed accept him. And those are things that are done under subsection 5 of the statute.
I think this is a theoretical discussion with the examination of the evidence, that you look at the evidence to determine whether the expert says it is possible for this person to live outside the institution. Doesn't have to find a place, but is it possible?
Exactly.
That, is it possible under the evidence, looking that you look at the circumstances of the behavior on the basis of the evidence to determine if it's possible to live outside the institution and keep the public safe, you're saying then. And that where the person will live, you look to see if the person can live and be safe, and maybe think about conditions of not having a person next to a school or another kind of place where a video place that might have materials that this person should not be exposed to, that kind of thing, theoretically.
Exactly. I think the court is being directed to consider what conditions of release would be appropriate, and if any conditions.
You might say, no, nothing.
Exactly.
Stay in the institution.
Exactly, and then the state would have carried its burden.
In that way, then, these are consistent sentences, you're saying.
Exactly.
It's like saying you can sentence a person to parole, and here are the conditions you can consider for parole.
So you would read the words, in making a decision. The word decision does not refer to whether or not the state has met its burden, but the word decision refers to a decision as to where to put them.
Well, in subsection 4, the words in making a decision, I think, have to refer back to the decision to grant the petition or not to grant the petition.
In the previous sense.
Right.
And, but then, in making it, now you've just lost me. Because that sentence reads, I think the relevant parts of that sentence read, in making a decision, the court may consider what arrangements are available to ensure that the person has access to and will participate in necessary treatment.
But I think the words, Your Honor, with all due respect, that you skipped over are the relevant words in the sentence. It says, in making a decision under this subsection. That's subsection 4. The decision the court has to make under subsection 4 is whether to grant the petition, which...
Well, why don't you read that sentence?
The court shall grant the petition unless the state proves by clear and convincing evidence that the person is still a sexually violent person and that it is still substantially probable that the person will engage in acts of sexual violence if the person is not continued in institutional care. And when it goes on to say, in making a decision under the subsection, that's got to be the decision it's talking about.
I agree with you.
Okay. If it's making a decision whether the state has met its burden of proof that this is a person who is still likely to be sexually violent and will still engage in acts of sexual violence if he's not continued in institutional care, the question becomes, are there alternatives to institutional care? Are there less restrictive alternatives that would still accomplish the goals of the statute?
You have to put that in terms of the state's burden of proof.
Correct.
Has the state proved that this person has to be continued in institutional care?
Yes.
Under this?
I think that's very true. And I don't think that the court at that point is being told there has to be a release plan that you consider that tells us exactly where this person is going to go, where he's going to stay, where he's going to live, where he's going to work, what kind of counseling he's going to receive or other support services in the community.
But it seems there I begin to part some company with you, counsel. Seems to me the state has the burden to prove that institutional care is required and would have to put on expert witness or whatever evidence or testimony that institutional care is required. It seemed to me that
the defense might rest, but that's always a little dangerous. The defense would put in evidence that there are types of care and treatment and living facilities, whether available or not, that could house this person and be publicly safe, right? And then the judge, this would be a judge decision.
Correct. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that it's not the burden on the defense to say, here is a halfway house that will accept Mr. Sprosky. But if there is evidence that some sort of a community placement will accomplish the ends of the statute, and the judge believes that and believes the state therefore has not carried its burden of proof, release has to be ordered.
I assume your witness would testify something to the effect that perhaps there should not be full release under 09, but that if the person got A, B, C, or D, certain kind of halfway house, certain kind of psychological access, psychological treatment, certain kind of access to medical or pharmaceutical treatment, etc., then it would be safe for the public.
That's correct.
And then the judge would have to decide, do you need institutional care, or do you need, or would something less than that work? That's your position.
That's exactly my position. Yeah.
That's how you interpret the statute.
That's how I interpret the statute.
And that's how you get rid of a conflict.
Exactly.
Mr. Kelly, why shouldn't we reach the issue of who has the financial responsibility?
Whether it's the state or the county, basically because Mr. Sprosky doesn't care. He wants to be released to a community setting. I'm an advocate for Mr. Sprosky. I don't represent a county. We don't have a situation in which a county has been ordered to pay anything. In fact, nobody's been ordered to do anything.
Don't you think it would help your client's position if indeed this court said the responsibility is with the state rather than with the county? Don't you think that would speed things along a bit?
Maybe in the sense that the state has more money than counties do, I could take that position, but I don't think Mr. Sprosky's freedom should hinge on who pays. And I don't think that's an issue which is ripe for consideration by this court. Nobody raised the issue in the trial court as to whether the state was going to pay or whether the county was going to pay. That wasn't something that Judge Kirchman was asked to decide. Nobody raised that issue in the Court of Appeals, and I don't read the Court of Appeals decision as making a decision on that issue. I think what the Court of Appeals told Judge Kirchman is that he has to require a county to prepare a release plan, and if there isn't a facility that's currently available, then it's up to the county to create some kind of a release plan that accomplishes the goal of the statute. The Court of Appeals didn't say who has to pay for it. So at this point, there hasn't been any kind of an adversarial relationship in this case that would squarely put that issue before the court.
But I was just going to say that in telling the county that the county has to prepare that plan, it seems to me that impliedly the Court of Appeals is saying, county, you better have a facility available. In other words, I think you can read the approach taken by the Court of Appeals as putting the burden on the county. And that's why it seems to me that you would want to take a position on behalf of your client.
Well,
otherwise, the next battle is going to be, you know, which agency, the state or the county or governmental organization, has the responsibility to meet the requirement.
I'm not sure that's going to be a battle, because I hear the state saying in this case that we agree we ought to pay for it.
Well, that's what Mr. Weinstein is saying. I don't know if he's really able to speak clearly for the state in that regard.
I would hope he does, but unless we get to a position where a county says we have been ordered to pay for this and we think the state should pay for it, and the state then says, no, we don't have to pay for it, it's the county's responsibility, until that happens, there isn't any kind of an adversarial battle that will ripen into a dispute that this court should decide. At this point, that issue just hasn't come up in the case, because nobody's asked, or nobody's ordered, rather, a county to spend any money on anything.
I just want to clarify. My understanding was, but I could be mistaken, that it is the statute that says that the county can be ordered to prepare a plan, that it is not, and that the Court of Appeals is merely following the statute. Is that wrong?
That's my understanding as well.
Okay. Counsel, one of your arguments is that the trial court never really did reconsider its order. Didn't it get to the bottom line and reconsider its order on whether or not there would be supervised release? I mean, that truly is the bottom line. So how can you argue that there wasn't a reconsideration?
Well, it revoked its order, but what I mean by reconsideration, and what I think most of us understand a reconsideration to mean, after an evidentiary hearing is one of two things. Either the judge considered the evidence that was presented at that hearing and for some reason reweighed that evidence, and I don't think we see that happening here, or the judge reopened that hearing and considered new evidence. Well, nobody asked Judge Kirschman to reopen the hearing that took place under subsection 4. Nobody presented any new evidence to Judge Kirschman that was under oath and that was subject to cross-examination, which would allow him to come to a different conclusion under subsection 4. The subsection 4 hearing ended. The court moved on to subsection 5. The court received a letter, essentially, from a social worker at the Wisconsin Resource Center, which said, we've investigated and we can't find an appropriate placement. If that was the basis for what the state calls a reconsideration under subsection 4, then I think that was clearly an error, because there wasn't an evidentiary hearing. She was not called as a witness. She did not testify under oath. She was not subject to cross-examination. All of the procedural safeguards which attend a hearing under subsection 4 were absent. If the court relied simply on this letter and said, I'm reconsidering under subsection 4, even though I haven't received testimony under oath and this person hasn't been called as a witness and hasn't been subject to cross-examination. So I don't think that was the kind of reconsideration that would allow a decision to be made that the state had suddenly met a burden of proof that the judge earlier said it had not met. The other issue that I just want to touch upon is this issue of cost and whether it's appropriate for the court to consider cost. The state suggests that the court should engage in some sort of a cost-benefit analysis here. Again, I'm not sure that issue is before the court because the court did not require a release plan to be prepared that it then said was so costly that it shouldn't be implemented. Our position is that the court should be required to require the county to prepare a release plan. If the county comes back and says, yeah, the state is right, we are going to have to spend, as they say in the reply brief, millions of dollars for one sexually violent person in Crawford County, then the issue of whether the court can consider that cost in relationship to the benefit of giving Mr. Sprosky his liberty as an issue that is properly before the court. But that hasn't happened. That isn't before the court because nobody has ordered Crawford County to spend a penny, and we don't know what it would cost. We don't have a record that tells us what the cost is of institutionalizing Mr. Sprosky at Wisconsin Resource Center, or how that would compare to the cost of some alternative plan. I think that the county has to prepare that plan. If the plan is we go out and build our own halfway house, or we find somebody else and contract with them, but we don't want to do it because it's too costly, then this court can reach the issue of whether cost is an appropriate factor. I doubt that most of the time it will be, because it doesn't say anywhere in 980.08 that the court should consider cost. I don't think judges are well suited to perform a cost-benefit analysis because there isn't any statutory guidance as to how it's to do that. For instance, if it costs roughly the same to institutionalize Mr. Sprosky at WRC as it costs to confine a prisoner, and I suspect it probably does, which is around $15,000 or $20,000 a year, as I understand that. And if the cost of community supervision would be $30,000 a year, is that extra $10,000 a year a good price to pay for Mr. Sprosty's liberty? Well, how does a judge make that decision? There isn't anything in the statute that provides guidance, and I don't know that the statute envisions that the court is going to place a price tag on an individual's liberty. I think this is a similar situation to the situation that arose in the DER case with regard to Chapter 55 protective placements, where the court says maybe in an extreme case where exorbitant costs would be involved, that might be an appropriate issue, but in the normal case, it won't be. I think unless we have a release plan ordered and returned to the court that presents some sort of an exorbitant cost, that issue isn't going to present itself to the court. But we're never going to know until a county is actually ordered to produce a plan that accomplishes Mr. Sprosty's release. That has never happened here, and that's all we're looking for. There was never a plan prepared that accomplished Mr. Sprosty's release.
So what do we do if we should agree with you? What do we do? Send it back to prepare a plan?
Send it back to Judge Kirchman, direct Judge Kirchman to pick a county, order that county to prepare a plan that accomplishes his release. That is what the last sentence of subsection 5 tells Judge Kirchman that he should have done.
Now, when you say pick a county, obviously it would be Crawford County or one of the four counties that have
it may be more
private institutions that are up and going at this time.
It may be more logical for him to pick one of those other four counties that have more resources available, but I think that's a discretionary decision, you know, that he should make in the first instance based on whatever information is provided to him.
The only counties he has are his own and the other four. He can't just pick any other county.
Based on the record as it exists at this point, that appears to be the case.
Right.
Now, on remand, if he wants to take new evidence and it turns out that there are additional counties with available resources, I think he should be entitled to do that. But I also think he should be required to comply with the statute, which says the court shall designate a county department to prepare the plan, order the county department to prepare the plan, and place the person on supervised release in that county. That, I think, is a mandate, and the judge did not follow that statutory mandate. That's all we're asking. He has to ask a county to prepare the plan. He can't accept the county simply saying, well, we can't prepare a plan, we can't find any resources. If the county says we have to build a new facility, fine, that's the plan. If the county says, well, this might not be as ideal as we would like it to be, but we're going to put him on community supervision with electronic monitoring, and instead of doing a halfway house, we'll involve him in outpatient therapy, fine, that's the plan. But there has to be a plan that accomplishes the supervised release, and there then has to be supervised release pursuant to a plan. That's what the statute requires, and that hasn't happened here. If there aren't any further questions.
I have a question if you're done. So I want to get back to sub 4.
Sure.
Under sub 4, the court has, as I see it, one of two decisions to make. One, grant the petition, or two, not grant the petition. In that second sentence, it says, in making a decision under this subsection. Now, at least as I heard you answering the Chief Justice, you were saying that that decision, the word decision, refers to something other than granting or not granting a petition.
No.
Okay. Well, then can you restate it, your aunt? How do you interpret that?
I think the decision that the court has to make is a decision to grant or not grant the petition. In other words, it's the decision whether the state met its burden by clear and convincing evidence.
So then in making that decision, the section says clearly that the court shall consider the availability of facilities.
I think what the court, as I indicated before, needs to consider is whether there are less restrictive alternatives than institutionalization, like a halfway house, like the community housing project.
But counsel, that's not what the statute, that's not what this subsection talks to. This subsection speaks only to a petition, not about the alternatives about where they could go a half house. That's why I'm having I'd sort of like to buy your argument, but right now I can't.
Well,
you answered that it's a theoretical availability issue.
Correct.
Not an actual on-the-ground availability issue.
Do you stay with that answer?
I do. I mean, the statute that, or the sentence of that subsection that deals with the state's burden asks the court to decide whether the state proved that Mr. Sprosty will engage in acts of sexual violence if he is not continued in institutional care. I think it is appropriate, given the next sentence, for the court to consider, would an alternative like a halfway house, which isn't institutional care, provide adequate protection to society, or at least has the state met its burden of proving that it would not? I don't think the court goes on to say, is there a particular halfway house that will take Mr. Sprosty at this point? That's what subsection 5 is intended to do. That's the release plan, and that's covered by 5, not by 4. That's the only way to reconcile those two subsections, I think.
There is no conflict if you do it that way.
I don't believe there is a conflict if it's read in that way, and I think that's the sensible way to read the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Weinstein.
May it please the court. I'm quite troubled by a view of the statute that says it's the theoretical availability of a lesser restrictive placement than institutional care that should govern. Let's assume that the state builds 4 or 5 halfway houses with relatively sufficient security, and they're all filled with 980 people who clearly can't be totally released, and the next person comes up, and the experts say, well, we think he's just like all these other people. Now, what does the court do? Order the state to build another facility? That, to me, seems to get us into some real serious separation of powers problems.
Well, maybe that's what the state agreed in enacting 980. And it can also amend the statute, I suppose. Then there'll be a question as to applicability to people now institutionalized.
Well, it seems to me that because, and there are other language in the statute that seems to direct the department to cooperate with counties and to contract for these facilities, indicates that the legislature probably had existing facilities in mind. Now, I don't think it would be unreasonable for the legislature to build facilities for this.
Well, were there any existing facilities when 980 was adopted?
There were halfway houses, and they were run by DOC, and it seems to me that's what the provision for DHFS to contract with either private or other public agencies for placement is there for.
Counsel, in the state's brief to the court in the Carpenter and Post case, your position then was the state statute's primary purpose is revealed by the language and structure of the statute, which provides for commitment to the Department of Health and Social Services for treatment with provisions for the